We have made some invitations. We have a public service commission that we work with, the Committee for Public Business Administration. And there is we've got the Auditor General who's also here. I'll just outline part of our program for today. We thought maybe we'd just adopt some minutes as members of Parliament. But now we're reaching an agreement that we'll take the minutes, including today's minutes, to the very first meeting of next year when we meet. Or if we can have a meeting between, because we do have some activities that are going to take place. Visiting of institutions, planning of other activities, interaction of many institutions that are stakeholders of public safety and administration, that we can handle at that level. But we'll have a further discussion with members as soon as the meeting is adjourned so that we can outline the plan of action and how do we interact with the areas that we've identified during the course of this year. So I'm actually requesting the members that after we adjourn, we can have a small meeting where we can agree how are we going to deal with our administrative issue. According to the program and the agenda, we are supposed to have a briefing by the Minister and the Presidency for National Planning Commission and Performance Monitoring, Evaluation and Administration. On the National Planning Commission and on Performance Monitoring and Evaluation. So these are the two ministers that are established in the President's office but are currently very busy and making sure that they exist and are properly established. I'll come back to that. The other issue we are supposed to will have a briefing by the Public Service Commission on the implementation of the Public Service Commission recommendations. All the recommendations and areas identified for implementation from the Public Service Annual Report, that is 2008 to 2009. I'm sure members will agree that we did have a brief with them not long ago, 2 to 3 weeks back, where we had the annual report presented. So we're actually taking further that annual report, because it's not only presenting the report, then the report is adopted, but there are areas of implementation that comes along, and we want to take it a step further for implementation, and part of the presentation and the discussion that is going to take place is along those lines. The other one will be a brief by the Auditor General on key issues identified for oversight and areas of collaboration. As much as we're going to have an outline of a broader presentation, but I'm sure the presentation will move to specifics in terms of the committee itself, our institutions that we oversee, and how are we standing as it is. And part of it will actually even guide us further, because we've interacted with most of them. It will guide us further in terms of where is it ready, where all is well and good, in terms of when we want to do interventions, what are the critical areas that we really need to intervene into. So we'll also use our assessment in terms of the past meetings, in terms of the past also agreements and resolutions that we have taken in terms of moving forward on other institutions. So basically, that's what we'll be doing today. Starting with the issue of the presidency, the ministers and the presidency. There is a cabinet meeting where both ministers are part of, and they wanted to do this kind of presentation personally because it's a start. And therefore, they really requested that we relook into that presentation that they're supposed to do. So in other words, we are not going to have a presentation from both the ministers, from Minister Colin Shabani and Minister Trevor Manuel. They requested that based on today's engagement, they wanted to defer, but they thought it's not proper in terms of what they had identified and what they actually want to interact with the committee. And we think we're going to take it further. We'll see how to handle it. Because it's one area that we haven't really interacted quite broadly. So we'll be remaining then with the Auditor General and the Public Service Commission. And in terms of the program, before the PSC and the Auditor General, I think that maybe we can stop if they accept that we have the Auditor General first. I can see the presentation is already projected on the overhead there. We will definitely have that. And firstly, before you even take up the podium, I would like to thank you for accepting this invitation and also taking further assignments of looking into areas that we just identified. We appreciate our interaction and we want to believe that it will add value in terms of the work that we'll be doing. Kevin is going to be doing the presentation. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning to everybody. Chair, first of all, thank you for the invitation. And I think in terms of liaison and getting the synergies right between the portfolio committees and our office, I think it's important that these interactions occur on a regular basis. And we are committed to this process of interaction. I'm going to start with the presentation. The presentation is going to focus on the role that the AG plays and basically what the AG does, and also on the three key areas that the AG has identified as focus areas that, if utilized, can influence the audit outcomes in the entity. If we look at the slide up, and I'm just going to move through the slides as we go through them, the reputation, promise, and mission of the AG. The Auditor General has a constitutional mandate, and as the Supreme Audit Institution of South Africa, it exists to strengthen our country's democracy by enabling oversight, accountability, and governance in the public sector through auditing, thereby building public confidence. And this is our reputation, promise, and something that we hold very dear to our hearts. Okay. If we look at the first part, and this deals with an overview of the auditing process and standards, and I think here it's important for the committees and those charged with governance to actually understand what it is we do and how we do it in order to exercise the oversight that they do. And if we see, to say the benefits of external auditing by the Auditor General of South Africa, and I think this is just as a point of note, we now refer to as the Auditor General of South Africa, not Office of the Auditor General. And when we talk specifically to the Auditor General, then it's Auditor General. So Auditor AGSA is an acronym for actually the office. Okay. The benefits of external auditing are to add credibility to the information that is provided by the entity, assist in the strengthening of the oversight, accountability and governance in the public sector, and assist in giving momentum to the process of transformation of financial management in the public sector and provide insights to facilitate foresight of decision makers. And I think that's quite an important part, because in any set of financial statements or any document that is provided, once that assurance is given through an audit opinion, then it actually gives the decision makers that more courage and information to make decisions, and thus making a difference in the lives of citizens. It's also important that this set of financials, etc., is reviewed in terms of giving credibility to service delivery and enabling service delivery. Okay, the next slide we will see is on the different types of audits, and this is the mandatory audits of the AGSA. You've got your regularity audit. The financial audit, this is to provide comfort that financial information is fairly reflected and to enable proper oversight of financial management. I think it's important to note here that these are the types of audits that we commonly sit and reflect upon on the audit reports that are presented by the AG. And yes, these are required in terms of Section 4 and 20 of the Public Audit Act and the opinion on the fair presentation of information in the financial statements. And this is the report that we utilize to actually express the audit opinion on the fair presentation of the information as presented in the financial statements. And these are the reflections on internal controls and good governance practices, internal audits, audit committees, legislative compliance, etc. We look at value for money through specific focus areas, transversal audits and sector auditing, and this includes the components of compliance auditing. Then the audit of performance information, and I think this is one of the crucial areas, been a focus area for the last 2 years by the office. Yeah, this is to provide comfort that performance information is fairly reflected and to enable good oversight of service delivery. This is required in terms of Section 4 and 20 of the Public Audit Act, and the conclusion on the report of the entity that deals with how well they have done against their predetermined performance objectives as set by the department and approved by the various committees. Okay, under performance auditing, this includes, and here we're talking about the discretionary audits of the AGSA, so we finished the regularity, now we've got to the discretionary. And here we look at performance audits, including environmental auditing. These are permitted in terms of Section 4 and 20 of the Public Audit Act. Here you have economic, efficient, and effective utilization of fiscal resources, and considers the effect of policy implementation but does not evaluate the policies. So here we focus what is commonly known as the three E's, being your effectiveness, economy, and efficiency of the utilization of these resources by entities. Okay, the next type of audits that we look at in our discretionary audits is the investigations, and these are permitted in terms of Section 5 of the Public Audit Act. These are the factual findings relating to financial misconduct, maladministration, and impropriety. These are based on allegations of matters of public interest. So our office does also have a section that deals with these specific types of audits. Moving on, we then have special audits, and these are permitted in Section 5 of the Public Audit Act. And these are agreed upon procedures. These are required reviews relating to, for example, donor funding, certificates to ensure legislative compliance, etc. These are normally upon request from the entities for us to conduct specific engagements upon in these areas. The next slide is dealing with the detailed audit process. Just to give some background, I think it's important to get an understanding of how we go about the audit process, is the engagement activities and planning. Engagement activities, this is before any of our audit work is performed. It actually talks about pre-engagement activities also. We determine the skills and competence that is required of the audit team, getting the right people to do the job. Establish the terms of engagement with the client, the responsibilities of management, and what are the responsibilities of the auditor. And then we move on to the detailed planning. We assess the risk at two levels. Basically, the overall at financial statement level, looking at the entity in total, and detail of account transaction levels, looking at individual amounts. Then, moving on, we've got the audit process, engagement activities and planning continued. We will see here we look at things that we look at are the understanding of the entity and its environment, understanding the accounting information internal control system, assessing the risk, our focus areas, determining materiality amounts, which would impact on user decisions, and developing the audit strategy. How, when, and how many times to audit in order to reduce the risk of an inappropriate audit opinion. Chair, in this area, one of the key things here, and I think it's very important the committee understands this also, because based on what we do here, the information flows into the audit report that you then see and then you provide the oversight on. For example, when we talk about determining materiality amounts, this is one of the very important areas in the audit process, because that will determine where an issue will be reported. For example, if an item, if the error that is picked up on the financial statement is not deemed to be material, then it will not necessarily then affect the audit opinion. So you could have an unqualified audit opinion because the area of error is not material. Okay, so materiality basically talks to what we consider that will impact or make the use of those financial statements, impact on the decisions of that use of the financial statements. And I think that's crucial, because there'll be a lot of questions, why did you not qualify the department on this area or this issue? And you will see 9 out of 10 times the rationale behind that will be because it was not material. Hence it would have not had a material impact on the user's decision of the financial statements. So I think that's important to note. And also here is crucial that a similar type of error in one entity could lead to a qualification or a modification of the report in that entity but not in another entity, depending on what the materiality levels for the two entities are. So I think that's also crucial to understand that. And I'm giving you this background here because in your oversight functions, I think these are key things that help you understand how the reports are written. Okay? So the next slide talks to the execution. And this is where we design audit procedures to address the risk identified in planning. So, give you a broad overview of this. We've gone through the planning stage, we've identified the risks that exist in the entity, and now we actually develop procedures to mitigate that risk. So we've identified that there's a risk, for example, in procurement. We now have to develop procedures to catch this risk and see whether this risk, we can reduce this risk by getting procedures and audit evidence to actually be comfortable with this risk. And we perform test checks. We do not do tests of all transactions accounts, 100%. And we have to get sufficient and appropriate audit evidence. These are terms that you would have heard previously. To give some context to it, sufficient means that we need to get enough evidence. Now, what do we determine as enough? Okay, what is adequate evidence? This is determined by the standards again. We've got an audit methodology that determines what the standards are that we utilize. And appropriate means the right type of audit evidence. This is a very important aspect, and I think it's something else for the committee to take note of and to understand. We do not perform 100% testing. Our audits are done on a sample basis. Now, if you look at a department, the transactions could run into millions. For us to audit those transactions 100%, I don't think we'll be able to complete those audits timelessly. Hence, the standards. The company, the auditing standards allows the auditor to actually do a selection and then extrapolate his findings across that selection. So you'll see a number of times there might be 10,000 transactions or a million transactions, but we will test maybe 100 transactions. And we then formulate an opinion on the test of those 100 transactions. The rationale behind that is because the standards doing scientific sampling allows us then to extrapolate our findings across that population. And this is a very important concept to understanding. We discuss it at length with the entities to get that understanding, but this concept is one that is accepted through the standards, and it allows us then to be more efficient and effective. Auditing the whole million transactions will just be an enormous exercise that will cost millions of rands. And hence we utilize this process. So I think it's to get that understanding. And just on this point, is there any questions or clarity that you see that needs to be given further on this issue? Because I think it's one of those important issues.
Okay, sorry, I thought you can go through this, but I can see you realize it's an area that, you know, it's a contentious issue, and you know we would have raised it a number of times. Maybe, you know, we've gone through it, but I don't know if members want to ask now, or let we allow the whole presentation to proceed, and then we can do the questioning at the end. Okay, let's proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, how do we get evidence is also crucial. We do it through people, paper, and place. This is discussions with individuals. Paper means looking at the actual documentation relating to the transaction, and place means we will get it from the various stations, substations, etc. of the entity. Moving on, Chair, you will look at evaluating, concluding, and reporting. This is where, once the execution is completed, we then start wrapping up the audit. We will review all the evidence obtained during the audit process. We report on identified potential exceptions, the qualitative and quantitative. Qualitative meaning the non-financial information, and quantitative being that the figures or the rand values as disclosed in financial statements. Here again, it's a point of note here, and I think important for the members to understand. When we talk about qualitative, these refer to, especially in the public sector, the various compliance issues that exist. So you're looking at your compliance with the Public Finance Management Act, compliance with the Treasury regulations, the compliance with the various acts and regulations pertaining to that entity. And here, the auditor would have to make an assessment as to whether those issues of qualitative are material or non-material, non-compliance. So unlike where you had the quantitative, in which you had the rand value to guide you, here you would have to make the call to say that the non-compliance in this area would have a material impact on the users of those financial statements. So, in other words, your materiality could be qualitative and quantitative. You have two materiality levels. Okay, the next is the management report. Okay, this is an important document that is given to management. It is a document where our audit findings are communicated to management via this report. Management gives responses and findings in writing to us, which we will then evaluate. And our report includes financial and governance issues, governance being the qualitative issues. And this is not a public document here. This is an important part also. But be assured that all material findings will then flow into our audit report. Why we mention this, and I think it's again an important point, is this document serves as evidence of the communication of the entity to the auditors on responses to the finding. And I think that is crucial because then it determines how we further report from there. Okay, the next part is on the audit report. The audit report is a reflection of significant findings in the management report. So from the audit report, the auditor will determine through the tools at his disposal, being that of the qualitative and quantitative materiality. Okay, and then the auditor will then again determine what is significant enough to affect the audit report or affect the opinion of the audit report. The audit report is a public document. The report is only public after tabling in Parliament or the provincial legislature as follows, the mandatory audits as part of the annual report of the auditee that is tabled by the auditee, and the discretionary audits as a separate report tabled by the Auditor General of South Africa. Okay, the next slide is on audit communication. The objective is to clarify audit expectations and ensure a smooth process and prevent surprises in the audit report. This can take the form of leadership visibility, that people like myself are present in a lot of these committees with the auditees, audit committees. We have also what is called an audit steering meeting with the client. From myself, senior managers, etc., will be present there to explain the audit process as I'm doing now, explain the expectations, etc. Engagement letters. We issue a formal engagement letter for every assignment that is then counted. It's then accepted, signed as acceptance by the accounting officer of the entity. Letters requesting evidence or clarify audit findings. These are called queries that we will then issue, requesting the entity to give us the necessary documentation for us to execute. Or also, when we have an issue that we raise, we will write it in this letter, and then we'll get a response, given a formal response to that finding. We will have structured meetings and agendas. We have audit steering committee meetings, as mentioned by myself, and then the report discussion meetings. The report discussion meetings takes a few forms. The first is with management, where we have a discussion on the report. It will be a draft report discussing the issues, giving management time to then look at these issues and not necessarily respond to the issues. The response will have already happened in the management report, but to discuss it. Then we will look at that and further clarify. We then have a discussion again with management on the audit report, which is in its final form, and then we have a discussion with the audit committee on the audit report before it is finalized into the annual report. We also review the annual report, but that is not an opinion that is expressed. It's merely a review of the annual report to ensure there's consistency in what we have gone through the audit process with, and to make sure that the documents contained in the annual report does not contradict what we are reporting in our audit report. Okay. Then as we say, much effort is placed in ensuring that all audit reports are beyond reproach. Chair, I think here it's also important that the communication process is one that is open and transparent, and we encourage that with the clients, etc. The next slide talks to the reports on financial statements, and here you'll see the auditor's report. It's a report on financial statements. It gives an opinion on the financial information as presented. It has an emphasis on matter paragraph, which highlights certain disclosures, and it is not a qualification paragraph. It is used to highlight certain disclosures as disclosed in the financials. Okay, the next area is on other matters. Okay, other matters give the root causes and a reflection on internal control, governance matters, and other reporting responsibilities, auditing of performance information. Okay, this is a part that I just want to spend about a minute to explain, because it's very important for the committee to understand this. The AG, I want to say, remember AG, Terence, in his presentations on audit outcomes and in his presentations on the reports of the Auditor General, he mentioned the term clean audit report. I think it's very important to understand this. Clean audit report means where there is no qualification, in other words, the audit report is an unqualified audit report with no other matters. The other matters is an area that we feel is very, very significant and needs focus. So my advice to the committees is, even if you have an unqualified audit report before you, the focus still needs to be on these other matters, because these other matters also represent red flags. It represents areas that are warning signals that if these are not properly addressed, it could lead to problems in the coming years. It could lead to modified audit reports later on. It could lead to financial breakdown, etc., in entities. Chair, one of the concern areas is, under other matters, you would see a lot of non-compliance issues. Okay. And in my opinion, there should be, non-compliance should be a minimum. To the extent that there should be no non-compliance issues, because these are rules that we have set that need to be in place. There need to be proper processes in place to monitor them, because these are rules that have been set for a specific reason, and these rules enable proper service delivery. And if we do not abide by these rules that we have set, then it's going to jeopardize service delivery at some point. So it's something that I think definitely needs a focus. The auditing of performance information, we've spoken to performance information. It's the entities submitting their performance for the year in the annual report on the various programs. And I think it's important here, Chair, that there's going to be this migration. And in the coming years, we're going to be issuing reports on performance information. So we will be expressing an opinion relating to this. And that migration, I think the entities need to make sure that they start ensuring the proper processes are in place to ensure compliance with this. And then our reference to our other reports is the performance audits, special audits, and investigations that I mentioned previously. Thank you, Chair. Chair, that is the first part of the presentation. It deals with those issues. I'm going to continue. The second part of the presentation briefly touched on the audit outcomes, and I'm not going to go into detail into that there. I understand, and for time constraints, I understand that this has been done by the AG and the various committees, so I'm not going to go in detail on that there. So I have to say that there is a presentation, and it gives the audit outcomes. So I'm then going to move on to the next part, and that is on the key focus areas for achieving a clean audit, and share that in the presentation documents that the committee will have. It will be on page 25. Chair, there's three key focus areas that the AG and the AGFA has been stressing. And those key focus areas is the quality of financial statements, strong governance arrangements, and effective oversight by leadership. Chair, with quality of financial statements, this refers to the ability to produce financial statements and quality management information throughout the year. It's the utilization by leadership of credible financial information to proactively address emerging concerns. Now, again, if you would look at a lot of the audit reports that we have issued, you will see that there's an area where, in other matters, we refer to material adjustments that have been made to the financial statements. And this talks directly to that. We believe that the financial statements, once produced by the financial team of an entity, should be seen as a final set of financial statements. And it should be free of any errors. Chair, we believe that this can be achieved, and it can be achieved through ensuring a few processes around financial statements. And the first one is ensuring that financial statements is produced on a regular basis. We talk about the monthly preparation of financial statements, and we don't believe that this is impossible, because at the end of the day, the financial management team, this is one of the core functions, is to produce financial information. We also believe that there should be proper systems in place to facilitate this process. And we're not talking about the purchasing of fancy systems to do this, but we're talking about proper systems instituted by the finance team to make sure that timely information is produced. And this information should be one that is credible, one that decisions can be made on and that can be made upon in a timely manner, so that service delivery can be enhanced. Chair, these three areas interlink, and I'm going to talk across them, because in order for us to have this type of financial information available in a timely manner, as you can see, we're going to have to have very effective leadership, because the tone has to be set at the top. The leadership has to take that responsibility and accountability to start instituting these practices within the entity. Also, those problems or challenges that are being seen as preventing these from happening in the entities, the leadership needs to take the responsibility to say, okay, let's identify these and let's start working on them to ensure that we can iron them out. And this is imperative. We feel that this has to happen. And Chair, if we can start getting this financial information timelessly, it means then that our oversight bodies, our governance structures, your audit committee, and especially your audit committee and your internal audit, can then start playing effective roles within the entity. Because what we believe is, once the financial information is produced, the role of internal audit becomes crucial. Because internal audit then can start reviewing this financial information together with the performance information. And this is important, because the performance information can be produced periodically. It does not have to wait for the end of the period when the financial statements for the period has been presented or produced. So I think it's important, again, that we actually start making sure there's processes in place, that our governance structures, our internal audit and our audit committees start getting information on a timely basis that is free of error and that is timely produced. And I think the portfolio committees especially needs to start asking the questions, is this happening in the entities? And I think that's one of the key oversight functions. How effective is the internal audit and the audit committees on ensuring that this process is actually happening? And also the leadership of those entities. Are they driving these processes? What will then be the outcome of this? And this is a crucial thing. The outcome of this will mean that we're going to then start seeing a change in the audit outcomes. We're then going to start seeing that there's an improvement in the audit outcomes and there's an improvement in service delivery. So one of the crucial things that we've identified is, for example, the non-compliance issues. And we ask ourselves the question, when the audit committee sits, do they sit on a regular basis? Are they monitoring these things? Are the chairpersons of those audit committees actually monitoring these things? Are they asking the question, from the last audit report where the non-compliance issues that we identified, have we addressed them? And hence, if they are repeating non-compliance issues, then somebody has to ask the question, how effective are those structures? Is internal audit actually looking at and reviewing the entity's non-compliance or compliance with the necessary requirements? And these are what we talk about, the effectiveness of those governance structures. And they need to start performing these functions, we believe. So, Chair, these are the three areas that we believe that becomes crucial. And we believe that the oversight body needs to start asking questions and also start ensuring that these things start happening. And hence you'll see the effective oversight by leadership. Also, the last point talks to the improved coordination and collaboration between the public audit committees and the portfolio committees. And we believe that to a large extent that the audit committees, the leadership of the entities, the internal audit structures, they need to start giving the assurance to the oversight bodies that they are reviewing and they are in tune with what is happening within the entities. So that's the conclusion of my presentation. Thank you. And take questions.
That is Kevin Luckman.
Yes.
Actually doing the presentation on behalf of the Auditor General of South Africa. Okay. I think even before we can even embark on the discussions, there are some few things that we need to look into, but I'll come back to you, Kivesh, on the issue of the audit outcomes. As much as we don't, you know, in fact, let me certainly correct that the presentation was done last week by the Director General for Public Service and Administration. Why was it that way? It's because as Parliament, we have actually started working at last away. So in other words, what that means is that we do collate some portfolio committees into one cluster, with the realization that most of the work that we're doing actually cuts across or, you know, interacts with one another. For an example, you'd be interacting quite a lot with public accounts, with Auditor General, a committee that deals with that, Mike Masuta, the chairperson there, and also Cody. So part of what we have done in the governance of this cluster that we actually coordinate as this committee, because it's coordinated by this committee, it's called Governance and Monitoring. That will be on the side of Parliament. That's the approach we're going to take. But that way it's overseeing the governance and administration from the side of government. So yesterday it was for the very first time we had a collusion of all the committees, and then we had the presentation, and those issues that you talk about were part of the presentation. So definitely they were done. As much as those issues were done, I would just still need you to actually maybe just touch on what are the issues about the audit, without necessarily getting into details, but giving us a picture, but also considering we did get a detailed presentation, not getting in details, but touching just over that these are the issues that we refer to.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, if I look at the key issues, just give me a minute to just get to it. But But if I look at the key issues that I would like to talk to as areas of concern, and what we refer to them, Chair, as the warning signals. And these areas are areas of human resources, areas of information systems weaknesses, areas of non-compliance issues, and areas of material misstatements in the financial statements. So those are the four key areas that we consider and we see as areas that are warning signals going forward, and the entities need to start focusing on these. And if I look at, just trying to give you a bit more detail on the non-compliance issues, these are the ones that we've identified for focus areas. That is the prevention of fruitless and wasteful expenditure, okay, as one of the areas. The credit is not settled within 30 days. The irregular expenditure not disclosed. The safeguarding of assets. The monthly clearance of suspense accounts. And the reporting on various aspects. Okay, so those are your various reporting, such as reports to Treasury, etc. And these are the non-compliance issues with the PFMA and Treasury regulations that we have seen from our work done, that is areas of concern and areas that need attention. Okay, thank you, Chair.
I think, honourable members and ladies and gentlemen, what you'd notice is that we've got the institution, particularly the ones that are doing the presentation today. You'd notice that they're independent institutions for a reason, of course, so that when we engage on other areas, we find areas of commonality on when we move forward. I'm sure there's been quite a lot that came in common between the Public Service Commission, between the Auditor General's way of working. We'll come back to that once we actually finish the whole of the presentation from the side of the Public Safety and Administration. But what I just need to also indicate is that at the moment we have been receiving the annual report, as we're talking about, part of what we'll be engaging further with the Public Service Commission. It's their annual report, but in this case it's not largely within the areas we highlight of the department, but on areas that we really need to further engage, which actually, while I was thinking about it while we were doing the presentation, it became critical for me to really know how then to approach the audit of the independent institution. Maybe once you talk on, or when other members ask questions, also just to see how then is approach on the independent institution. How is that conducted, just for the benefit of information. And also, you talked about your chapter, section 5, when you talk about Supreme Audit Institution. When we say Supreme Audit Institution, what is it exactly that you're referring to? Just for our benefit, to be sure that we're all moving together with the same understanding. We appreciate also that you are the same way as government is creating the 2014 clean audit. You know, it came up very clearly on the, you know, we talk also about the, those that are that have no qualification at all, but the issues of disclaimment, which I'm sure the members have captured it quite seriously, that how then do we really assist, you know, that will be assisting the process of the 2014 of the clean audit once we all move together. In terms of ensuring that we look into the areas that can assist this country to have clean audit. You know, and also in the light of, you know, last week there was this strong discussion of a developmental state and what are the ways that we need to all implement, you know, from the side of, you know, from oversight, what kind of an oversight do you want to do in order to assist for us to have a developmental state. So these are part of the very concrete discussions that Parliament has started to talk about, you know, and where ourselves as your own institutions can actually also interact. I think without actually touching much, I will have to allow the members to pose questions from the Auditor General of South Africa's presentation that was done by Kavish. Honorable Williams, and will be followed by Honorable Van Skalkwyk.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've got a few questions. First of all, in Section 22C of the Act, it says that the performance is measured against predetermined objectives. And I just want to know where those predetermined objectives come from. Because fundamentally, is it the entity that decides which is those predetermined objectives, and therefore, you know. Also, the materiality, I'm not too sure what you were actually saying there, and I would like a bit more in-depth explanation to what that means. Further on the standards, when you talked about there's a sample-based testing. So who chooses the sample and on what grounds? And are those grounds uniform? In other words, then, how you test one entity, you test them the same in another entity so that we have something to compare them to. Also, if the evidence is sufficient and appropriate and qualitative and quantitative, in other words, then, is there a standard on those, those definitions? Is there a standard on them? In fact, in one entity, it might be something, and the other one is you've got a higher standard, or I don't know, is it standardized across all the entities? And then I just would like to know that do you believe that the entities have the capacity within their finance teams to produce or to give you the correct information for you to produce clean audit opinions? And like you said, I'd like to know, is the information that you're receiving at the moment sufficient and appropriate and qualitative and quantitative? I mean, what is the bottom line here? I mean, are you just not getting the right stuff yet? You'd like to tell us. Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Williams. Honorable Franz-Kalkwyk.
Thank you, Chair. Most of my questions have been covered. I would just like to know, sir, what is the way the audit report goes since it's been made available or published, or does it come to the portfolio committee first, or does it go to SCOPA? I'll tell you why I ask this, because it happened in the past that I read some of the findings in the audit report in the press before the portfolio committee discussed it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Members. Is there any other question, Honourable Mohan?
My question is to the lady, what do they do after giving an opinion, like when you have a name or an address report, besides giving an opinion, you know that your life is fine, different, something like that, but you write on your phone, but in the next year, if you found the same thing, what do you do as the AD? Besides as writing that report, what do you do to assist by the family? And another thing that I would like to know is your relationship with the audit committee, because basically audit committees do that, look at the internal control systems and so on, but the government say, what do you do, what is your relationship between the audit committee and the AD? And another question is, where does the internal auditor section report to? If they report to their accounting officer, then what if they find a problem with their accounting officer? Where do they report to the internal auditor section? And the other thing is this aim, the suppress account. What is supposed to go into the suppress account? Because it seems everything that we throw into the suppress account. What is it that is supposed to go into?
Thank you,
Chair. I can see there's definitely a hunger for knowledge in the committee, but I'll try my best to answer them. Chair, the first one by Honorable Williams, the issue on the predetermined objectives. Chair, those objectives are set in the strat plan of the entity. The entity actually sets these objectives in the strat plan that then follows the approval process. through eventually Parliament and the Minister, and then once those step plans are approved, they then have to, in their annual report on the performance against those predetermined objectives. Okay. The next issue on materiality. Chair, materiality is set by a standard. When I refer to the standards, I'm talking about the international auditing standards. That is the standards against which we conduct our audits. The financial statements are prepared in terms of, there's various different standards applying to financial statements. The provincial and national departments is set by the standards as prescribed by Treasury. They give a guide that sets the format for the financial statements. The public entities, they produce financial statements in terms of international accounting standards, or IFRS. And Chair, if we look at materiality, materiality is a concept that is utilized through reporting. Now, you get materiality for the preparation of financial statements, and you also get materiality for reporting. Now, I'm going to focus on the materiality for reporting. What materiality says, and I'm going to use an example to try to make it a bit more understandable. If an entity has expenditure of 10 million rand, and if there's an error of 5 rand, materiality says that the use of the financial statements, decision to invest or to utilize that entity, is not going to be affected by the 5 rand error. So we have to set that base of what that level is. There is a standard that governs that. For example, the auditing standards makes reference to 0.5% to 1% of expenditure, or 10% of gross profit, or 10% of the asset base. So it does give you guidelines. The standards does give you guidelines as to what the materiality level should be. But the level is set also based on the risk that you associate that audit with. And I'm using terms here, sorry, I am using technical terms, and I can explain it a bit more, less detailed. In other words, if we perceive that entity to be an entity that is very strong in service delivery, it has good financial management, etc., then we say the risk of that entity is very low, and hence the materiality level then would be one that is acceptable. So instead of setting our materiality at 10,000 rand, we can set the materiality at 20,000 rand. Okay, because we're saying that there's lesser risk in that entity. That translates to when we are drafting of the audit report, we then look at whether the error as reported is below or above materiality. If it is above materiality, we then have to say, does it affect the audit opinion? That is a qualitative, that's a quantitative, pure quantitative. Qualitative refers to, for example, if there's a non-compliance with an act or a non-compliance with the regulation, we have to then evaluate whether that non-compliance is going to affect the user of the financial statements, or that non-compliance is so significant as to warrant that financial statements to be materially misstated. Okay, I hope Honorable Williams has give you a bit more clarity. The next one is on the sampling standard. Yes, it is also governed by the international auditing standards. There's a standard for sampling. It gives us direction as to how we have to sample, what's the criteria we have to utilize. And yes, again, it will be a standardized process. It is based on risk. In other words, the higher the risk, the more samples we will have to have. So if we had a low risk, we could get away with maybe 30 transactions. But if the risk is high, then we might have to do 100 transactions. Okay, so it is based on risk. But again, it will be standard, and it's set by the standards. There's very little judgment in it. The fact that we use random sampling then enables us to also extrapolate the errors. Extrapolating the error means that we can apply the principle of our conclusion to the population. The evidence that we have to gather and what constitutes proper audit evidence is also governed by a standard. It gives you a definition of what constitutes proper audit evidence. It also gives you the definitions of how much evidence you need, okay, as an auditor. And this evidence forms is in the various forms. For example, audit evidence can take the form of a document. It can take the form of a representation from management. It can take the form of analytical reviews. And it can take a form also of external information. For example, when you circularize a lawyer, to ask a lawyer, or you circularize a debtor, to ask the debtor whether this payment is due. So that is on audit evidence. On the capacity within the finance of clean opinions, Chair, this varies. I'll be honest with you, this varies from entity to entity. We've come across, I've got quite a diverse portfolio that I look after. And with that diverse portfolio, I've seen in some entities there is very strong financial capacity, and it's reflective of clean audit reports that these entities produce. And in some entities, it is begging for interventions in the finance teams. And I think if you look at the outcomes of the audit reports as tabled in the annual report, you will then be able to also reflect upon the financial capacity. So for the portfolio purposes, I think if you have to look at the audit report, you can 90% of the time you get assurance that if there's problems in the audit report, you can see that also linked to acting capacities within entities, lack of proper financial support. You will look at poor leadership and those type of things. Okay? Honorable Winfield, I mean, I hope that addresses most of your concerns. Honorable Van Schalkwyk, you want to know the process of our audit report. Our audit report is finalized. It is given to the entity. The entity then places this audit report as part of the annual report. The annual report, before it is tabled, is sent back to our office. We review the annual report. We review to make sure there's consistency in the process of our audit, and nothing that is contained within that annual report contradicts anything that we have said in our audit report. The annual report is then tabled in Parliament. And once it is tabled in Parliament, then it follows the process of the various committees. Whether the portfolio committee comes before the Standing Committee on Public Accounts, I'm not sure. I think that will be something that the committee can take further within Parliament and find out what is that process. But I'm not too sure on that. Our process generally stops once we have reviewed the annual report. And we then make sure there's compliance with the PFMA, which requires the annual report to be tabled within a certain period. That's normally 5 months after the conclusion of the financial year. So we make sure there's compliance. If that compliance is not done, we then issue a separate report on that. Okay. Honorable Mulani, you asked, what do they do when there is a bad opinion? Chair, we have engaged because to exactly what you've spoken about, the clean audit reports that we are pushing for 2014, this imperative from government we are supporting. We have started engaging with the leadership within the entities, especially where there's opinions, modified audit opinions, and when I say modified audit opinions, you talk about qualified audit reports, you're talking about disclaimers, you're talking about adverts. But beyond our communication with the leadership, we have started to drive processes of influencing those in leadership positions. We have regular sessions with the ministers, honorable ministers of the portfolio, to discuss the audit outcomes. We request that the entities start forming action plans to address all the audit issues. And those action plans, we have requested that the audit committees monitor, the internal audit starts reviewing, and we sit in, and we will cover some of the other questions also, we sit in every audit committee of the entity. And when we sit in the audit committees of the entity, we also review as part of our audit process the action plans to address the previous year audit issues. And if we see that there are gaps, we start reporting these gaps also to the leadership of the entity. Okay. So in the next year, what do we do with these bad opinions? We don't start in the next year, we actually start in the year that it is there.
In our audit report, we also, in our surrender audit report, in the management report, remember I made mention to the management report that we give to management. In that report, we give a description of the root cause of what we believe has caused this area of concern, and also what's our recommendation to management of how we think that they can proceed to actually correct it. So we also provide that information. We monitor how management implements these recommendations. Okay, and it is just that, it's a recommendation. Because ultimately, management is responsible and accountable for those actions. But that starts in the current year. Not in, we don't even wait for the next year. We start in the current year. So if you've got a bad audit report, for example, this year, then we start this year with the interventions. And the relationship that we're engaging now with at the higher levels with oversight bodies is also part of that process, because we want to drive this process very hard from the top. We believe that the tone has to be set at the top. Okay. The relationships with the audit committee and the AG is a very strong relationship, Chair. We have embarked on attending all the meetings, but I personally, in my portfolio and so with the other business executives, the other portfolios, we personally interact with the chairpersons of the portfolio, chairpersons of the audit committees, and also our senior managers or ourselves interact with the chairpersons and with the committee itself. We sit in those committees, we give comments to those committees on not only the external audit issues but also the internal audit issues and the information that is tabled in. And we, the same presentation I've done to yourself on the three key focus areas being the leadership, governance structures, and quality of financial statements, we also have rolled that out throughout the entity and the audit committees, etc. Where does the internal audit report to? The internal audit report, and I think you'll be pleased to hear this, they report to the audit committee. They do not report to the management of the entity. But also, I think an important thing is, especially in the entities that have boards, the chairperson of the board also plays a very important role in making sure that the internal audit is effective within that entity. Suspense accounts. This has been one of the areas of concern for a very long time. But the PFM and the Treasury regulation is very clear on it. The suspense account is supposed to be cleared on a daily basis. Okay. So it's not supposed to be one that where your suspense account is financially and supposed to have massive balances sitting in there. Chair, with suspense accounts, I believe it's one of the key things and one of the crucial things that needs to be focused on also, because a suspense account is not meant to be an account where amounts are dumped into. I'm using this term very loosely. It's supposed to be an account that is basically a holding account for a very short period. But that account is supposed to be well supported by all the appropriate evidence. So if you've got an amount in that suspense account, you should know where it is coming from. You should know, you should have all the documentation for that value. You should have all the information pertaining to that value, and it should be cleared on a daily basis. Okay. Chair, I believe those are the questions that have been posed. And if there are any additional questions, additional responses, I'll gladly take them. Thank you, Chair.
We have a question.
Another
good medium. And
thank you, Chairperson. I was just following up on the disclaimers and the adverse outcomes, and you said that you make requests for them to comply, and you've got meetings and things to try and fix the situation. Now, what happens if they just continue this downward spiral? Also, what about things not reported on in this audit outcomes departments and entities in legislatures for the 2008-2009? There's one national department that wasn't reported on. So does that mean that you didn't even get the opportunity to see any information from them, and they just didn't submit that? And in that case, what do you do? I mean, how much can they resist you? You know, how much powers do you have to force them to give information to you? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the first part of when there is a disclaimer and adverse opinion and through our interactions and interventions, nothing happens. I think it's a very sad state of affairs when that does occur. Because what we then do is, because of the audit process being governed by the standards, we have a responsibility in the next year to report. And if there's another disclaimer, then we report as such. I think this is where it becomes crucial of the role that the oversight bodies play also. Okay? Because the oversight bodies then need to start exercising the powers that they have in bringing to account these entities that are continuously producing these adverse and disclaimer reports. But we like to believe that we are trying to have an impact at the very highest level within those entities. So the legislative authorities within those entities, we are engaging with those levels to make sure that where there's these type of outcomes, that that level of leadership is fully aware of what's driving those outcomes. And those, that level of leadership is actually involved in trying to resolve it. And we've been very successful in getting the cooperation of those charged with that level of governance. With, in response to the one department that has not been reported on, that is because the audit would have not been completed at the presentation of this, at the doing of this trend. It is not necessarily that the audit has not started. There's various reasons for that. It could be that there's certain audit outcomes that we are still waiting for. There could be trying to be clearance of certain issues. It could be a late submission of financial statements, etc. But again, it does not just stop there. We still report that and the rationale and the reasons behind that to those charged with governance, to the relevant minister, etc., so that the interventions can happen at the top again to prevent these occurrences all the time happening. So thank you, Chair.
Honourable Mohani.
My question is on the management system. If I hear you correctly, you said that it's not a public document, but the management system is not going to go to the audit report. But my worry is, what is the CA that you are getting into this, that you find in this account statement? And if you have a statement that you don't want the public to know about, so that it is not owned by management and doesn't have to go to the public, what is the way that I've just been like, because of the time, hiding, you are hiding to the public, you don't want them to know about this thing. Here they are there, you want management to know about them, but you don't want management to know about the same stuff to the audience, and say, no, you are. You want to bring a very good report, even though there are some things that are not good.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, let's see. Today's the difficult questions. No, Chair. Honourable Rani, it's not that, I promise you, and you can be assured that it's not about hiding issues. What it is about is the management report, and I think, okay, I'm not going to go into that detail, but the management report has basically three areas, it consists of three areas. The first area is matters that affect the audit report. Those are the most crucial and critical areas. The next area is significant areas, okay? And the last area is what we call housekeeping areas. So when we conduct an audit, we have a responsibility in terms of the standards to report on any finding that we have. So even if, through my observation, I looked at something and I said, the garage, the workshop of the entity, had a bit of oil spilled on it, and that little bit of oil had not been cleaned up, for example. And in my observation, I say, you know what, This is not going to affect the opinion of the financial statements, but it could have the impact of an employee slipping and hurting themselves on that. So I will report on it. I will not just go and communicate this by verbally talking to the workshop manager. I will then write it in my management report. It might fall under the category of housekeeping issues, but I will bring it to the attention because I want it to be tracked. So the next year when I go in there and when I review again and I look at the floor and I see the oil again, then I would say, you know, this is normal now, housekeeping issue. It's now a significant issue because nobody's taking action on it. Okay. So that is how you get these categories. So the other two categories of significant issues and of issues of housekeeping are issues in terms of the reporting standard. And this is in terms of the international standard, the auditing standard. It does not meet the criteria for affecting the audit report. It meets the criteria for our communication with management to say, for example, the significant issues in the management letter is again like a warning signal saying, look at these issues, they are important, they're not affecting your audit report, but we believe that you need to start paying attention to. And the housekeeping issues are issues that they're not that important, but look, you're going to need to address them to have an entity that is completely free of any errors, etc. So those are the issues that we deal with management directly, and we engage with them on it. Those issues that are affecting the opinion of the financial statements or affect the audit report are issues that are critical in your management report, and those issues are then transferred through to the audit report. So it is not an issue of us trying to withhold information. Sure, thank you.
Okay. If there's no further question, Honorable Magalek. Thank you, Chair. I was interested in the question that was asked. The relationship between the internal auditors and the auditor general and the report, where they report to. Because we think the internal auditors, they are the ones who can alert the department before they get out of control.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable Mulalek, that's a very important question that you're actually asking. And although internal audit reports to the audit committee, we have a very, very close working relationship with the internal audit. So we meet, the auditor general's teams meet with internal audit on a regular basis outside the audit committee. Now, you would have heard this expression of placing reliance on internal audit, the work that internal audit does. It does not necessarily mean that if the Auditor General does not place reliance, because that review is done in terms of a standard also, it's the International Auditing Standard 610. But it does not mean that if we do not place reliance on the internal audit that we do not engage with them. We still engage with them because a lot of work that they have done throughout the year, for example, risk identification, for example, knowing the client, getting the environment, to know the environment better, we actually engage with them and discuss this with them so that we understand what are the key issues and where to focus on. So those engagements between us is very, very strong. But yes, they do report to the audit committee. They do not report to management. Their ultimate reporting line is to the audit committee. Just to give you that sense, the audit committee is a committee that is independent of management, and internal audit through the reporting structure is also independent of management. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Lacon, thank you, but I don't think we have reached the end of this because there is a further request, if you remember, that focuses specifically on our area of operation, that is within the institutions that the Department of Public Safety and Administration, including the institutions that are under the department. I don't know if you would like to give us an overview in terms of where we are currently.
No, Chair, that is fine. Chair, I can give you a brief overview of the Department of Public Service Administration and the entity, the Public Service Commission, PALAMA, the
Sita. And Chair, just to give you some background there, all those entities have had an unqualified audit opinion for the financial year with other matters. The other matters ranged from the financial statements containing material misstatements, okay, to issues around non-compliance with legislation and policies and procedures. So I think the key thing here is the focus is going to be on the other matters and how to get that right. I think with some of the entities, the financial capacity is a problem and that needs to be addressed. I believe in some of the entities, the issue of acting positions needs to be addressed. They've been acting for a very long time within the portfolios that they currently hold, and I think that needs to be addressed. So although it's commendable that the entities had unqualified audit opinions, I think the focus has to be on those issues of other matters and on the financial capacity within the entities. That's something that questions need to be asked as to what's the progress on that from the representative leadership of these entities.
Well, of course, I realize maybe there are issues that we definitely cannot disclose. Our opinion is that we have been engaged openly in the same institution, and there's been quite a number of other things that came our way that needs our attention. I can just give you an example of the CETA. Openly here in the community, we have been engaged, and we thought maybe we can have a benefit of this and that, but perhaps it's what rules and restrictions which also tie our knowledge now. I don't know why would it be that way, but nonetheless, if there are matters that are still working on, I think we'd have to further engage on other areas, because we do have a knowledge of other areas, but what is critical now is how we move forward. Like I indicated, we will be going to constituencies with members and also doing oversight. So part of the things are the ones that came out, particularly during the presentations of this nature here in Parliament, where we're still going to further engage with other institutions. With that example I gave you, CETA, for instance, there's quite a lot that we're going to work on. Parliament as well, we have some further areas that we're going to be interacting with. And of course, we definitely need to get the benefit of what has already been worked coming to us, so that we actually utilize that as well as part of the information that can make us work better and, utilize what you actually say that you need, that, a high, involvement of authority in terms of doing that. Well, precisely, we've got the responsibility to do oversight, and we were very ready and willing to do it quite thoroughly, as much as it's delegated to us. Okay, I don't know if members want to engage on that, but well, I understand that I'm sure we're trading on, sensitive ground. I'm not sure why, but I don't know if members really want to engage, but we'll understand if I think that you really don't want to disclose. Honorable William?
Sorry, Chairperson. Yeah, I'd just like to know, like you were saying, if there are real serious matters, we need to know about them. And if it's not here, we need to know about them somewhere. That's all. Thank you.
All okay with this, then maybe we then have to proceed. You want to say something?
Chair, I can elaborate a bit with your permission on some of the entities, if that is what you require.
Yeah. Yeah, I think just take us through in terms of that, and I think was part of the brief in terms of what you requested you to do, what you let us overall, but we also want our area specific. Yes, of course, in future, you're not going to interact with us as a committee, because we'll be a cluster, so it will be the whole governance, so it will pull all those aspects. Well, we've got a presentation of the nature that happened last time. But for now, it's just the committee's benefit. I'm sure it's the last time where some of the things will come to us just as a committee. Maybe it might be the last time, but we therefore would really like to benefit if there's a way or you are ready to do that.
Sorry, Chair. Just give me 1 minute.
Okay. We can take a 5 minute break just to give Mr. Lachman a space to just break on that. I know it won't take very long. Sure.
Yeah, I will give some background as to what were the key areas as identified in the audit report, and just give some background to some of the entities from my experience. You know, just to give you a bit of background as to why I am talking to this and why I can talk to this. Part of my portfolio, the DPSA, is part of my audit portfolio that I'm responsible for. So I actually sign up on the audit report for DPSA. So the entities within the portfolio is the Department of Public Service and Administration, DPSA, the Public Service Commission, PSC, the Public Administration Leadership and Management Academy, known as PLAMA, and PLAMA Trading Account, and the CETA, State Information Technology Agency. So those are the entities that fall under this portfolio. Okay, Chair, I'm going to start with DPSA. The audit opinion for DPSA was an unqualified audit opinion with other matters. And the other matters was the non-compliance with applicable legislations. And they did not have an updated strategic human resource plan for the year ended 31 March 2009 as required by the Public Service Regulation Part 3, Paragraph D1. That would be in the audit report. So if you wanted a reference for this, find it, you would be able to pick it up straight out of the audit report. Yeah, and that audit report would be contained in the annual report that they would have submitted to Parliament upon tabling. In fact, all the issues that I'm going to refer to would be the source of that information would be the annual reports of these entities. Chair, I think one of the key things here is, and I think it's an area that is very simple to rectify, it means that there has to be proper training, there has to be proper coaching around the necessary understanding of what is required and implementation thereof by the staff of the entity. I don't believe it's something that cannot be achieved, something that can be achieved quite easily. Chair, the next one was on Public Service Commission. Public Service Commission also received an unqualified audit opinion with other matters. And Public Service Commission, the other matter was non-compliance with applicable legislation. The Public Service Commission did not pay all qualifying suppliers within 30 days, as required by Trade Regulation 8.2.3. For this one, Chair, I think you would see from the detailed audit reports that this is quite a common occurrence in majority of entities. But again, it's one that can be managed. It just has to be a proper system of financial management. So basically, managing your cash flow. Okay, and I think if we have that proper facility. Why do we highlight this? It might seem like it's just a non-compliance, but there is an underlying to this. If you look at the majority of firms out there that rely on their cash flow, especially the BEE firms. Okay. If you're going to hold up payments for a long period for these firms, it can have a drastic effect later on. And especially with the bigger departments where you're looking at your departments that like your health and your education, where they're using service providers from BEE sectors, those payments need to be expedited because they rely on that pay their wages and etc. It can have an impact on employment, etc., and the government imperatives at the end of the day. So that's one of the key things that needs to be focused on there. Then the Public Service Commission did not pay sponsorship monies received into the National Revenue Fund as required by Treasury Regulation 21.2.2. As you're aware of this regulation, says any funds that are received must be paid directly into the Revenue Fund.
Those are the two non-compliance areas there. And again, we say in there, it's issues that can be cleared up quite easily. It's, you know, just proper leadership interventions can be sorted out with systems, etc. When it comes to Palama with the vote, again, they also received a financially unqualified audit opinion with other matters. And the other matters for Palama were they did not have an updated strategic human resource plan for the year ended 31 March 2009. And this is as required by the Public Service Regulations Part 3, Paragraph D1. So the next one is on the Palama trading account. They also received a financially unqualified audit opinion with other matters. And the other matters referring to trading account was the annual financial statements were subject to material adjustments as a result of the audit. And I think I've covered quite a bit of explanations around what is meant by that. Chair, and then I think the last one is FITA. They received a financially unqualified audit opinion, also with other matters. And with FITA, they had non-compliance with applicable legislation. They did not have a procurement process that was efficient, fair, equitable, and competitive, and transparent, as required by Section 51(1)(a)(i)(1) and Treasury Regulation 16(a)(3). A contract management system that facilitates these requirements was not in place during the financial year. Then the entity did not comply with the PFMA Section 53(3) because there was no application was lodged with National Treasury to obtain the necessary approval to accumulate surpluses since the 2003-2004 financial year. So if you want to accumulate surpluses, you have to get permission from Treasury, basically. The next point is the entity did not comply with Section 22 of the FITA Act because service level agreements with departments and public bodies were either not signed or not concluded. So in other words, the SLA that FITA has with all the other government entities was not in place. I'm just trying to translate it into easily understandable language. So there was also non-compliance where FITA did not comply with Section 10(1) of the Act, of the FITA Act. The Board of Directors did not comprise of an executive member who was a designated managing director and also did not have a legal expert. The position of CEO was vacant since 31 July 2008 and the legal representative position was vacant since 31 January 2009. FITA did not comply with the PFMA Section 51(1)(a)(1) and Treasury Regulation 6(a)(3) because a tender was awarded to a bidder that submitted an invalid tax clearance certificate. Okay, also, FITA needs to obtain stability in the leadership structure by filling the posts of the CEO and the CFO. These are vacant posts. And there's been people acting in these posts for a lengthy period. And we believe that this leads to a lack of strategic direction for the organization. Obviously, these posts are crucial posts as part of your leadership structure that we've been talking about this morning. And we believe that this is one of the important areas that needs to be focused on. Also, we believe that the culture within the entity towards governance and compliance needs to be improved. And there has been a lot of areas where there's been concern around the workings between the management and the committees, the governance committees within CETA. We are also aware that the Honourable Minister has been working very diligently and hard to address a lot of these issues. And I think they're making some strides in there. Then, continuing in the non-compliance, we again saying that these legislative requirements, it's imperative for them to comply with. It's imperative that there's proper processes, proper systems in place to ensure this compliance. CETA has embarked in in upgrading and replacing Oracle system. And in so doing, there's been just so much delays in a lot of things that even the audit process was delayed because we had identified material adjustments to the financial statements that needed to be effected. And again, the system took a long time to implement and resulted in the audit also being delayed significantly upon request of CETA. So as I said, the financial statements were subject to material misstatements for CETA. There were significant deficiencies in the design implementation of internal controls in respect of financial and risk management. Prior audit findings have not been substantially addressed, and the information systems were not appropriate to facilitate the preparation of quality financial statements, as I mentioned, with the upgrade of the systems. And there were significant difficulties during the audit concerning the availability of the information that we requested. And then I talked to again the roles that your leadership and your governance structures need to play to make sure that these things actually happen. Yeah, I think that's detailed the key areas around the audit of the portfolio. And that, I think, is the specifics of the issues actually on the audit. Thank you, Chair.
Sure. No, thank you very much. I'm sure members will agree we needed this information. It actually gives us confidence that areas that we are actually targeting to move into, were they relevant or maybe they were not. So in terms of this information, it actually complements most of the areas that we already realized that we need to really move into. And we thank you for that presentation. I don't know if members want to interact. I know we've been really engaging with this many a times, and we already identified plans. With this information is an add-on. I don't know if we really want to enter into this. Okay, I think members are fine, but surely that information gives us that confidence that, okay, these are the areas that we think they're paying. And it shows that we do need to work quite slowly, particularly when we move on those areas. I don't think we need to take a break. Should we then proceed? Because what I just wanted to clarify is that you can realize that the institutions, like I indicated, that are here are independent, all of them, and they are existing constitutional books, to be chapter 9 and chapter 10, like two chapters. 9 and 10 in the same room with the committee today. Of course, it was going to be even more interesting if we had performance, the Minister of Performance Evaluation and Monitoring as part of seeing how then we interact jointly. We were really looking forward to that. And then we can also realize that both the institution does the monitoring of government and of executive as well. And then they have the powers, the power to recommend, the court's power to recommend in terms of the findings and so on. Of course, you might be differing in terms of reporting. Nonetheless, honorable members, we will move to the presentation that will be done by the Public Service Commission. And then I'm not sure if the Auditor General will want to leave, because I think there's a lot that you want to discuss hereafter. Of course, we made a commitment ourselves and the Public Service Commission that we really want to engage in terms of our way forward. So we want to keep up to that commitment because it's very critical to sharpen our focus moving forward. Can I hand it over to the chairperson of the commission, Professor?
Professor.
Can I leave it to you, Kobe Chakras? Sorry, just a bit of another conversation, just to interrupt you. Tea is going to get cold. Maybe we rather grab it first before we get the presentation. Otherwise, it's going to go cold and it won't be nice. So, can just take 5 to 10 minutes of tea break, then we'll proceed with the public service commission.
Chair, honorable members, thank you once more for inviting us to your committee. You have sent us a brief on the implementation of the recommendations of the Public Service Commission. This is a matter we have discussed before. It has been on the table, but we did make promises that would revisit it with a view to tightening that up. And today, the acting director general will present on this issue, and will include, apart from the challenges, will include also measures that the Public Service Commission is taking in this area. The second area are issues that you identified from our last presentation on the annual report of the Public Service Commission. Now, we really had challenges there because you just listed the issues, and so we didn't know what was the substance, but again, the acting DG has tried to speak on each one of those areas. Now, before I hand over to him to make the presentation, I particularly was very pleased to be present when the last presentation was being made, and also enjoyed some of the comments that the chair made, particularly on the clustering of portfolio committees. So maybe if we can get a bit more feedback on that from the committee, because I think that would be in the interest of the commission in the light of the visit that we've been making to various committees of parliament. The second reason why I was interested in the presentation of the Auditor General was this issue and the discussions that arose around the repeated disclaimers of departments and what happens next, because that is the same story that we have when it comes to the recommendations of the Public Service Commission. Now, how we view and discuss the recommendations of the Public Service Commission, I think we should bear in mind that kind of discussion so that we're able to draw the similarities but also outline the differences between the Auditor General and ourselves. Without going into the issues, let me ask the acting DG to make a presentation.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mgijima, Chairperson, honorable members. Presentation will make some introductory remarks and then talk to the implementation of the PSC's recommendations. Here we had two options. One was to have the graphs and tables and so on showing which recommendations were made to which department, when, and what the status and so on. But given the sense of the limitations of time, we felt that a useful discussion here would be to talk more about trends and the challenges we face and how we can improve on this situation going forward, working closely with the committee and other committees of parliament. So that is the approach that is being taken there. And then the second issue is the one that Dr. Mgijima has raised, the seven issues identified in the letter from the portfolio committee for follow-up emanating from the PSC's annual report, which we presented to this committee recently, and then some concluding remarks. Starting with the issue of recommendations here, we really use recommendations as a key measure to direct departments to improve upon their performance. We provide different kinds of recommendations emanating from our investigations, emanating from our oversight research, all of this culminating recommendations that are made to departments for purposes of improving their performance. What we do is that we intend also monitor the implementation of these recommendations, and we think this is important for at least two reasons. One is that it helps us identify departments which do not take these recommendations to heart and implement them so that the necessary interventions and follow-up can be made. But we also use the feedback that we get from departments to inform our strategies and programs. One of the things we do is that even before we say this is a final report with the recommendations, we engage with the particular department to which these recommendations are directed, and we say, let's get comments from you on these recommendations. And it's something that we're beginning to increasingly go into to make sure that we get feedback on the implementability of the recommendations themselves, so that when we say recommendations are not being implemented, it's not because they are not well-informed recommendations, making it difficult for them to be implemented. So in this presentation, we will talk about how we monitor the implementation of our recommendations, the challenges we face as a commission, the assistance that we need from Parliament, and then we focus briefly on the seven areas of follow-up that we identified in the letter from the chairperson. A critical tool that we have now put in place as the Public Service Commission is a protocol for tracking and monitoring the implementation of the recommendations of the PSC. And this protocol basically as an internal document says, once we have put recommendations in place, this is how they should be captured in a database of recommendations, this is how they should be communicated to departments, these are the specific arrangements that should be made with departments for them to provide us feedback on the implementation of this recommendation. So as the slide says, they are communicated through what is called a management letter, and in the management letter we draw the attention of the minister, or the NEC, or the HOD to the specific recommendations that the department is expected to implement. We also direct the minister, NEC, or head of department in terms of the time frames within which feedback should be provided to the Public Service Commission on whether the department has implemented the recommendations or not, and also the willingness of the Public Service Commission to make a presentation on the report or the specific matter that has been investigated. So that is really the content of the management letter that we sent out. And where appropriate, we also highlight the problems and risks or consequences that may result from non-implementation of the recommendations. And we also indicate that in those cases where the recommendations are not implemented and no valid reasons are provided to the PSC for non-implementation, that's where now this committee comes in, because we would like to. We engage with departments, we get the information, the recommendations get implemented, but where we are not making headway. And this is something that we'd like to raise with departments, that we will then come to the portfolio committee and Public Service Administration and say, out of the 100 recommendations we issued, this is the progress we've made, but in terms of this 10, we've tried all the measures at our disposal as the Public Service Commission, and we are not making headway. And we would like Parliament to step in and assist in this particular area. So if it's those that relate to the provincial department, the same approach will be followed in terms of the relevant committee in the provincial legislature. What are the challenges that we have been experiencing in this area? I think the key thing has been that of feedback on the implementation. So you issue recommendations and you'd like to get information on whether they have been implemented or not, and that information is not forthcoming. And we give an example here for the 2008 period here, that we issued 933 recommendations to departments, and we know that 91 of those recommendations have been implemented, because departments have come back to us to say, yes, we have implemented them. But the majority of them the feedback on whether they've been implemented or not has not been provided. And that's where now we try to chase, to say, provide us with this information. And we will then come to a point where we believe we're not making enough progress with the department, and that's when we escalate this matter to Parliament. But what is encouraging for us is that where we have received information on generally on the status of the recommendations, the implementation rate is quite high. Now, how are we addressing these challenges ourselves? What we're doing is, if the time for reporting on the status of the recommendation passes and the department doesn't come back to us, we issue a first reminder, and then we issue a second reminder. What we do in the second reminder, and this is something the Public Service Commission Act allows us to do, is that we can summon anyone to appear before the commission to provide information that the commission needs. So we then use that provision in the Public Service Commission Act to summon either head of department or an executive authority to come and appear before the Public Service Commission and to provide the information that we've asked for. It is our belief that this step is really a last resort, if you like, because if you can imagine, if departments don't cooperate, then we have 300 recommendations around which we don't have information. Instead of conducting oversight, we spend a lot of time in someone's hearings, which is really not the way we would like to use the resources of the Public Service Commission, because it would not be very good use of state resources. So that's why we provide that opportunity through a first reminder. But if you look at the other measures contained in this slide, that the advocacy part of it on the findings and recommendations, if you look at what we do with one of the MNE systems that we use, where we take a department, we've taken the constitutional values and principles of public administration and have converted them into a measuring tools of progress in departments. So when it says high standard of professional ethics must be promoted, we've converted that into a set of indicators, and every year we take a sample of departments through this system. Once a draft report has been produced, we get a meeting with top management in the department, and we present the report and the recommendation to top management so that they can be binding in terms of the findings and the recommendations we make. So that they, you don't have a department that says, well, we actually don't have an idea what the PSC is getting at here in terms of these recommendations that are being made. So that is an attempt on our side to try to improve our advocacy work around the findings and recommendations. The issue of agreeing with the appropriate department on a specific implementation plan for the recommendations, and the Public Service Commissions are being available to provide support to the department in implementing recommendations. These are the measures that we try to promote to improve the rate at which the recommendations are implemented and the rate at which we get feedback from the department on the implementation of these recommendations. Although the information is not forthcoming, you see, for example, because we are involved in facilitating the evaluation of heads of departments, you see when we prepare for the evaluation of the head of department in the annual report of that department, reference to the PSC having said the following thing, and this is what we have done about it. So you actually find out accidentally when you look through the annual report of the department that the recommendations have been implemented, but there hasn't been a formal response to the PSC to say, in response to your letter, this is what has been done with those recommendations. Now, I think towards the end, when we get to the last slide, we'll come back to this issue of the recommendations, just in terms of how the Parliament can assist in this area. But just a quick one in terms of the areas that were identified for follow-up. One related to inadequate information provided by departments when submitting grievances. In terms of the grievance rules, grievances have to be resolved as close as possible to the point where they occur. So in this case, in the departments themselves. But if the grievances cannot be resolved and the aggrieved employee is still not satisfied with the decision that was taken at the level of the department, it can then get escalated to the Public Service Commission. The aggrieved employee may ask the executive authority to refer the grievance to the Public Service Commission for our intervention. So that's where we come in terms of grievance resolution. The challenge here is that we don't get provided with adequate information to the PSC, for us to pronounce on the grievances, and then we have to follow up and follow up and follow up. And again here, the issue of summonses usually comes in as well. In the area of grievances, I think this last year we've had to do quite a lot of summonses, where we summon heads of departments. An employee says, I am aggrieved as follows, this needs to be done. The reaction is not taken, the matter is escalated to the Public Service Commission, and then you write letters to say we need the following so that this matter can be finalized, and that is not forthcoming. So we've had to end up summoning heads of department to appear before the Public Service Commission to bring the necessary information. And that is an ongoing challenge. Of course, in our annual report, one of the issues we raised around this one is the fact that there is a tendency to take a shortcut. Instead of having the grievance dealt with, as provided for in the grievance rules within the department, it's escalated immediately to the Public Service Commission. And in those cases, we always say, no, we are not having the authority to intervene at this stage. It's only once the executive authority has pronounced on the grievance and the employee remains aggrieved and requests the executive authority to escalate the grievance to the Public Service Commission, that we can come in. It's a matter of education, but it's a matter of also insisting on sticking to what the grievance procedures provide for. The issue of maladministration, human resource management, and procurement irregularities. Here in the annual report, we talk about the mechanisms that the Public Service Commission has in place to facilitate reporting on corruption. We have our PSC's complaint rules, and we have the National Anti-Corruption Hotline as well. So apart from people going through the National Anti-Corruption Hotline, we have complaint rules where people can still register a complaint with us without having to go through the National Anti-Corruption Hotline. So we receive the allegations of corruption and the complaints through those two channels that the Public Service Commission has in place. The difficulty here is that we are dependent on departments providing the necessary evidence, and in many instances this information is not provided timely. Once an allegation has been reported to us, one of the first steps to take is to go back to the department and say, this allegation has been made we go to the head of department and we say, this allegation has been made about one of your senior managers. And what is your response as a head of department in this matter? Now, you then end up having to keep pursuing the department to give us the feedback that we need in this case. And again, the issue of summonses comes in, unfortunately, that we then issue summonses to the head of department to obtain the information that is necessary to deal with the issues that will have been reported through the National Anti-Corruption Hotline or through the complaint rules. What we have also been trying to do is to bolster the investigative capacity within the commission itself, so that in the number of cases that we ourselves investigate as opposed to referring them to departments can increase. But of course, our limited capacity doesn't allow us to do that. So there is a certain number that we will be able to take on board ourselves, investigate and finalize, but there are areas where we still have to rely on departments to come in. The report that we have produced on the state of professional ethics in provinces, one of the things they have pointed out is that departments themselves don't have that investigative capacity, that their capacity are assigned to this area to investigate cases that have been referred to them is not strong enough. So I think it's the 2008 State of the Public Service Report. We have said categorically that here we just continue to put aside resources as government to bolster the capacity in the PSC and to bolster the capacity in the department so that these cases can be investigated. Because if that doesn't happen, then it runs the risk of compromising the credibility of or such mechanisms as the complaints rules and the National Anti-Corruption Hotline, because the follow-up to the people who reported these cases will not be on time. A side issue that was raised is contradictions, inconsistencies, and ambiguities regarding the management of conflicts of interest. Now, a number of these have been put on the table already, the gaps that exist in terms of the current framework of managing conflicts of interest. For example, the fact that the framework focuses specifically on senior managers and does not deal with middle managers or people who get involved in procurement the processes in departments and for whom it will become quite crucial for the disclosures of conflicts of interest to apply. Issues that relate to the disclosures of spouses and so on. A key issue here that we are raising is that recommendations have been made already by the Public Service Commission to improve the current framework of disclosures and to improve its implementation. And there is a process that is driven by DPSA at the moment to improve the current framework, taking into consideration the recommendations that the Public Service Commission has made. The fourth area is that of governance and monitoring. I did indicate that we have a system that we use, or governance monitoring system, which takes the constitutional values and principles of public administration, converts it into a monitoring tool. So for each value, we have two or so indicators. And annually, we take a sample of departments, more like what the Auditor General does, working on the basis of samples, and we assess the extent to which they are meeting the requirements. There is an area there in terms of misconduct, because we've reported that cases of misconduct in departments, they take too long, we have people suspended. The capacity to deal with these cases within the time frames that have been provided is a challenge, and it needs to be dealt with. And of course, we did raise, I think, when we spoke to the committee previously, that even in terms of the functions imposed, that there are inconsistencies in terms of the functions imposed. At one stage, they may say in this particular instance that the nature of the function is made lighter by the fact that you have been with the public service for a very long time, which shows that there is loyalty on your part and so on and so on. And in another instance, also the fact that you've been in the public service for longer actually makes things worse, because you understand the public service, but you should have known better. So you have the same the sanctions that are given for the same kind of misconduct being inconsistent, and we've raised that as a concern as well. The Auditor General deals with the issues relating to performance indicators, but we have raised that in our report as well, emanating from the governance and monitoring system, the quality of indicators that are contained in the plans of departments. There is a constitutional value and principle that says public administration must be development oriented. And what we have done in terms of our system, we have said that one of the critical things for development orientation in the public service is poverty reduction. And we are asking a question around how the particular department plays a role in terms of poverty reduction. And here we just the information we get is unacceptable. Part of the problem in our assessment is that the understanding of departments in terms of their role in poverty reduction is not adequate. We have a lot of instances where, if you try to get information on what they are doing in this area, the simple response you get is that we are not involved in poverty reduction, and which is quite worrying, that you have a government which talks about poverty reduction as a priority, something that it has to achieve through the public service, and then you have a department that says, no, we are not involved in poverty reduction. And of course they are, but I suppose their understanding of how they are contributing to poverty reduction then becomes a problem. In our individual report and the consolidated report that we produce, when this report comes to this committee, members will see that we have departments that score zero when it comes to development orientation, because they just said we are not involved in poverty reduction.
the issue of taking feeling vacancy as well, they need to be done within 30 days, 90 days. There are two periods that are provided for. There are periods that there is a period that is provided for within a resolution that was raised within the PSCBC. But these time frames are not adhered to. There are instances where it takes even more than a year to have a vacancy filled. And I think this affects the capacity of departments to deliver, because if those vacancies are critical posts that people must fill so that the department can perform its duties, that then becomes a challenge if they are left vacant for a very long time. The one on meeting representativity targets, that is a common one. We have reported about it before, but particularly when it comes to people with disabilities, most of our departments are not doing very well in meeting the targets that have been set. When it comes to gender, the 30% that was set for 2005, there's been good progress there, but now we have 50% that departments had to work towards by the end of March 2009, and the progress there has not been adequate. Verification of qualifications, this has been raised as well as an issue for follow-up. Just a few things to raise here is that we did three projects as a commission. One, we verified the qualifications of SNS members in 2001, and then we followed up with the verification of qualifications of middle managers in 2005. And then after that, we realized that this work must be done within departments themselves as part of mainstream management, the verification of qualifications. It can't be done by the Public Service Commission all the time. So we then produced guidelines on the verification of qualifications, which step by step seek to indicate to departments how do you do the verification process. Then in 2008, what we did was then to go back to departments to see the extent to which they are using those guidelines, but focusing on levels below middle management, which is basically level 10 and below, to see how they were verifying qualifications. So we produced three reports, one on senior managers, the other on middle managers, and the other on levels below middle managers on the verification of qualifications. But we see DPSA now has a project on its work plan that looks at following up with departments to make sure that the verification process is done by the departments themselves. But because we have an interest in this area, it's an area that we keep watching very closely to make sure that the verification process takes place. Effective implementation of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, that's another area that was identified by the committee. Here, in all the reports that we issue, we have indicated that implementation is not satisfactory. And we believe this can be dealt with, because there are very clear manuals from the Department of Justice. There are training programs from Justice College on the implementation of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. So you can't then, it's then difficult to understand why there continues to be inadequate levels of implementation. And this affects service delivery, because if we take the example where the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act becomes particularly crucial. If we take it as an example, let's take the area of social grants. In terms of the Act, Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, if I apply for a social grant, the Act requires that the decision to grant or not to grant the grant should be made by a properly authorized person. So I cannot apply and somebody phones me and say, no, your application was not successful, if that person is not properly authorized to make that decision. So I have a right to know that this is a properly authorized person who made this decision. But that decision must be communicated to me. That's what the Act requires as well. It must be communicated to me. If I am not successful in my application, I must get reasons which explain why I wasn't successful in my application. So you can't just write me a letter say, sorry, you were not successful, and then we leave it there. You must explain to me why I was not successful. Secondly, you must also indicate, if I am not happy with the response that you have given me, what recourse have I got? And these kinds of things are expected of departments as provided for in the Act. So in our system, monitoring and evaluation system, we take a sample of administrative decisions in the departments that we go to. So, and then we take those decisions through the provisions of the Act to check if they were made by a properly authorized person, to check if the reasons were properly communicated to the persons affected by the administrative decisions, that they were, it was indicated to them what they should do if they are not happy with them, all those kinds of things. And that is on that basis that we're saying that implementation in this area is not adequate. The final area that was raised is that on the report on performance agreement as a performance management tool. Now, this is a report we completed last year, was tabled in Parliament. Now, it's a full report and can take a 20-slide presentation on its own, but we thought let's just raise about four critical points emanating from this report. Just to explain that because we are monitoring the implementation of the performance management and development system in departments, one of the things we always insist on monitoring is whether managers enter, officials enter into performance agreement on time. And we've been reporting on this where we believe compliance is not enough. But last year what we said was that, a question may be asked whether performance agreements are useful anyway, whether it's a useful tool, whether people should be using another mechanism for managing performance as opposed to performance agreements. And so we embarked on this study to look at a comparative analysis, looking at other countries and so on. Are there other mechanisms that have been used other than performance agreements? And we came out of that study also having interviewed managers to say, is it working for you? If it's not working, what do you think should be in its place? And the overall sense coming out of that is that they are actually a useful management tool. And they are being used in other countries as well, and quite successfully so. But there are certain requirements. If you look at the second bullet there, they mustn't be entered into for compliance purposes only, because DTSA says they must be concluded, and the Public Service Commission is going to ask if you've concluded it. You sign the performance agreement and then put it away. It cannot be a useful management tool if you're doing it for compliance purposes only. Also, it shouldn't be used for punitive purposes. It has to be used for developmental purposes because it's an instrument for managing performance. Obviously, if the performance is not adequate, there are provisions for managing poor performance that must be followed. But the performance agreement should not be seen as an instrument for punishing a subordinate, because then it loses its value. It cannot be a useful management tool if that happens. In our case, we also identified a challenge with the format and requirements of performance agreements. There is a sense that every time something is not being done in the public service, we say, well, it should be made as a compulsory requirement for inclusion in the performance agreement. So you end up having a performance agreement that is just too long, has too many things in it, and therefore it ends as not being a useful management tool anymore. So you can't keep throwing everything on the performance agreement to say it's only on that basis that it will be done by the department. That's the issue we are raising there around challenges emanating from non-compliance in other areas. We say the way to deal with them is to put them on the performance agreement, and that really now makes performance agreement less useful. But there are other issues here also to take into consideration. There are requirements such as all HODs should have a compulsory key result area called regional integration. Very good intention there that all, because we're working towards regional integration, there are NEPAD programs and so on and so on. But we found that the extent to which heads of departments themselves understand what should go under that particular key result area is a challenge, particularly in provinces where departments will say, well, I mean, there isn't much regional integration happening in treasury in the Western Cape, for argument's sake. Now, when you say to me, I should be measured in terms of a key result area around regional integration, and the department is not doing work in that area, what do I do? And we have made recommendations in this report that these are areas that should be looked at so that there is a clear understanding around what the expectations are when we go into this area. Just to go back to the issues relating to the recommendations, once we completed reports, they get tabled in Parliament. We have seen with some of the reports, and we saw this being a very useful development in Parliament, that we have the report discussed by the committee. The committee goes back to Parliament with the certain recommendations being adopted as resolutions of Parliament. Now, that gives us a very strong base as well when we go back to the department, because you're saying these are the resolutions of Parliament, that following things must be done in your department, and they have to add weight to those recommendations the moment they become the resolutions of Parliament as well. And that's one way in which we can be supported by Parliament. The other way is in terms of generating debate on the key issues that we're raising. There's a topical thing around financial disclosures that particularly SCOPA has been driving. But we're saying that these kinds of discussions are very important. They shouldn't die down. They shouldn't fizzle out. And what Parliament can do is to say, what are the key issues emanating from this report? And let's keep the debate going within Parliament, with the executive, with departments, and so on. Now, like we have indicated, where we are not making progress with departments in terms of them implementing or giving us feedback on the implementation of our recommendations, we would like Parliament to use its authority to say, department so-and-so, what is the problem here? Why are these recommendations not being implemented? And let's get a commitment from your side to say, within this particular time frame, those recommendations will have been implemented. We believe that if we put these measures in place with regard to the recommendations, the compliance rate, the implementation rate, the feedback rate will be enhanced substantially. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Maybe before we take questions, there's an issue that Dr. Fitzmaurice around the issue of clusters. And I really appreciate that you raised it, because therefore, I know we did talk about it even some time back. You see, really, in terms of that approach of doing things. Of course, we are initiating a process of working jointly with other committees, a process that we are shaping, and we believe by next day it will get a proper shape, because we already started, meaning that we did collate all the committees, that's policy and governance, and we had all the teachers from, you know, all the and the minister. Of course, we're intending to have most. And during the discussion, you know, what's interesting in governance, I don't know if I'll be able to capture all the committees that fall within, but we had that in fact, we didn't get maximum participation on that day because there was a lot of clashes. But we got a maximum integrated presentation that showed that all of the issues are quite related when there was a presentation and the rest. So within the governance and administration, made a presentation. Okay, let me see. Governance and monitoring from our side in Parliament. We have the public accounts. We've got Auditor General, Committee that deals with Auditor General. We have public service and administration. We have cooperative governance, cooperative governance and traditional affairs. And we have women, youth, and people with disability. Home Affairs is largely from the cluster of government. Because one issue that we raise is that we have noticed that there is no sort of synergy, there's no correlation between the cluster that government have, the cabinet. In fact, there's a cabinet cluster, there's departmental clusters, there's parliament thinking in terms of clusters. It's not exactly the same, but it goes towards one direction. And we just accepted that will be shaped along the way once we go. But definitely, in terms of the governance and administration that we had from the side of government, Home Affairs was also there. It was also doing the presentation, and we're going to maintain it that way for now. It makes sense. It was all issues that are raised. They've got an administrative implication which we got from Home Affairs. We've got the private members' legislative proposals. There's also two other committees of yes. There's a committee on traditional authorities that we have in Parliament, which is part of this cluster, and the Rules Committee falls within this cluster. There's a committee that will be initiated, I'm sure it is already initiated, that is a transformation committee, which deals with the transformation of Parliament, which is also will be on this cluster. And there are the two new departments, the planning in the presidency and the performance evaluation and monitoring in the presidency. It's just huge. But definitely bigger cities, all issues are related. And it's much, much easier when we work together. And when we, you know, because we did have discussions with the chairpersons, we do meet with the chairpersons of these committees, and we've realized that the sooner we do that, the better for all of us. You know, we all need it. And the more we talk, the more we realize how much we need one another. So from next year, we actually believe that Parliament is going to ensure that that process is underway. And I must say, as his trust of governance and monitoring, we would be putting a lot of pressure also on government itself, or on Parliament itself, to ensure, as much as they want to do that, but we also have the pressure to assist that it happens. And I'm sure we are definitely going to initiate the better way. The other issue, it was the issue of our relationship with the NCOP, the National Assembly and the NCOP. So also it's part of this whole process of trying to transform Parliament so that it does available oversight, you know, because we are all initiating a better way of working, and we think this will work best. So meaning that from the coming presentation, it will be unlikely where, you know, we will have issues, so we want to just pause as a committee, look into other things, but most of the time, we will be a cluster. Okay, so that's just the return of, that's the one issue which is going to continue to, we'll continue to engage on that one. Can I then find out from the members if there are issues they want to raise based on the presentation? There's a hand from Honorable Sam Scalvey, and another hand from Honorable Bikani. I'll take the two for now.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to make a comment, and then I'd like to ask a question as well. Every time I listen to the Public Service Committee, I get very excited and I am very encouraged. Because to me it is clear that cooperation between the Portfolio Committee and the PSC is of crucial importance. And I think that is the place to start reversing public dissatisfaction and maybe public disillusionment with the public service in our country. I want to thank the Public Service Commission for what they do, and also asking for cooperation with the Portfolio Committee. And then I want to ask a very simple question. I don't know whether the answer is so simple. You referred to the performance agreement, sir, and it's got to be simplified. So maybe that is the answer to it. But my question is, why are there so many managers who do not sign performance agreements? I can't understand that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. My pleasure for being here. My first question is on the conflict of interest framework that the DPSA is developing. And as to how far is that process and what follow-up mechanisms are in place for the Public Service Commission to to ensure that it becomes a process that becomes advocated to the relevant people in departments, so that when you start implementing or applying measures, they actually have full insight of the requirements of that framework. Because I get the feeling that sometimes we have a tendency of wanting to charge, but you find that people are not informed in as far as those policies or frameworks are concerned. The next question is on the vacancies. If you are mentioning the fact that within 90 days vacancies have to be filled, what measures are in place or what monitoring systems are in place to ensure that those that are not filled within 90 days are specifically attended to in terms of compliance? Then finally, Chairperson, I don't hear much being said. I don't know if it's an area that you haven't looked at, but in efforts of an integrated system of skills development. Skills development is very scattered. If I take a particular area, which is the relationship between, say, a CETA and the department, there's a lot of looseness in how training is being conducted in departments, and one ends up wondering if the relevant targets are reached for training and if the relevant priority areas have been identified by the Public Service Commission to see if there's any improvement in terms of capacitating people in the departments. So I'm just wondering if the Commission has ever considered or looked into an integrated system of training for the department, for everything that concerns public service. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Any other questions for members? Okay, can I allow the Public Service Commission to respond?
Thank you, Chair. I think the question, first of all, I think I must say thank you for the recognition of the work of the Commission. The question, I think, for me, which is very important, and I think which is the subject of today, is really the question, why are there so many managers who do not sign the performance agreement? I think that if you look at this area of recommendations on the Public Service Commission, is that apart from performance agreements, the extent of non-compliance is really huge, it's very big. In this area, we have outlined here in this committee before in terms of how the numbers of the heads of departments, how a big number of them still do not sign performance agreement, let alone the senior manager. Apart from that, even the evaluation of the heads of departments, which we have reported here before as well, that a non-compliance there is non-existent. Now, I'm not talking about financial disclosures, which we have outlined in the recent past. Now, if you look at this trend here, I think it becomes very obvious that we must target to change that situation as government, as everybody, all stakeholders. I think for me, this needs to be a focused area to say we can make recommendations, we can try, but I think that we need now to confront this area and be able to say what really does it mean? Because if it's in the regulations, if it is the law, I don't think we can ignore it. I don't think we can have business as usual when these lapses are there. If you ask for the reasons, say why is the non-compliance? I think it's in the nature of people to ignore their imperatives sometimes, even though it's against the law. So I think that we need to have a deliberate effort to ensure that we bring back, we reverse the winds that are coming off in the area of compliance. Now, the Auditor General's representative here was at pains to say what happens when there's a retreat in the disclaimers. But there came a point where he said, well, I think oversight bodies must take over, you know, if it doesn't happen. So for me, the question is, at what stage and how can we do it? If you compare the Auditor General and the Public Service Commission, you will find that that the resources are unequal. If you look at the area that is widely known on the Auditor General's work, it is the area of regularity audits, which are contained in annual reports of departments. Now, that fortunately is quite high profile now, fortunately, in our government. Our practice in public administration. We look at the annual reports and we are able to say whether an audit of a department was favorable or not. And the Auditor General did that insofar as the public service cluster that was here. But if you take the other audits that the Auditor General does, like the discretionary audit that he was talking about, and you look at all the work of the Public Service Commission in the area of governance, I think DJ did talk about the monitoring and evaluation area. These areas also of non-compliance that I've mentioned. In that whole area, I just don't think that we are focused enough on those areas. And I think it is those areas that we need to ensure that we turn the wheel, that we're able to decide what are the decisive actions that can be taken. We know now that if departments have got an unfavorable audit, regularity audit, the media, the public, everybody is interested in that issue. But in all these other issues, it is as if we are talking to nobody. And the area is wide, and this is where the resources come in. Because if the area is wide, then that support that we give, the SMDG was also talking about the support that we give. The Auditor General also spoke about the support that is given to those departments that are not pulling their socks. But if you look at the extent, the area in which we are dealing it, when we're dealing with human resource practices, when we're dealing with all these areas that we're presenting in today, then with the resources that are available, then it becomes almost impossible to hold the hand of every department in these areas. So I think for me, this is really the crux of the matter. The area of conflict of interest is also fraught with non-compliance, as I've said, in financial disclosure. What the Department of Public Service and Administration has done is that it has taken from the studies that the Commission did both in 2007 and 2008, and taken the recommendations, they worked on them, and as I understand it, that is being engaged with the cabinet towards the approval of the recommendations that the Public Service Commission has made in that particular area. Acting DG, do you want to?
Chairperson, I think it's probably the 2007 State of the Public Service Report. Where on this matter of performance agreements, we made a comment that if you had the signing of performance agreements by managers being elevated to the state of the nation address of the president, and we indicated at the time that it was actually said that something this basic can be elevated to that level when the president talks about critical priorities of combating corruption, fighting crime, growing the economy, and amid all those things, and also signing performance agreements. So it was subsequently put on the government program of action to follow up with departments and to have departments report on an ongoing basis. But at the end of the day, something like this, there is a requirement, and there comes a point where steps have to be taken against those people. Disciplinary steps can be taken against managers who do not complete this performance agreement. And there comes a time in public administration where that kind of step will have to be taken. If the manager is at fault, because in some instances you have managers who say, I completed mine, submitted it, and there was never any feedback. So wherever the gap is, it needs to be identified and action be taken, because this is a very basic administrative practice where non-compliance should not be tolerated. And it gets even promoted even further, where you find that somebody who does not have a performance agreement end up being given a merit award. Now, on what basis do you get a merit award? Because this is a performance bonus that you're getting based on us having assessed how you have performed. Now, what is the basis of that assessment if you didn't enter into a performance agreement? So these are just the straightforward steps that have to be taken at management level if compliance level remains this unsatisfactory. The issue that the Honorable began raises around the how far the DPSA is with the process, our information is that the process has been raised at the level of cabinet. There's work that has been done and has been taken to cabinet, and cabinet has asked for further work to be done on the framework, which is what the DPSA is working on now, and they will then have to be expected to go back. But I mean, of course, once again, where the PSC will come in is once you have the framework like that approved, our advocacy through our oversight work becomes critical. Just the same as we do with performance agreements and elevate the importance of performance agreement through our oversight work and advice, the same way will apply here, where through drawing attention to the importance of the framework, the areas where there are gaps, that will have to take on board as the Public Service Commission. The measures to ensure that the vacancies are filled within 90 days. If you look at the report that we have produced around this area, one of the things we have identified is the lack of department specific recruitment and selection procedures. Which says this is how we go about the process as a department, the issue of the advertising, how it gets handled, the issue of the delegations, if you're going to raise an advertisement, at what level in the department, depending on the position that you're advertising, the issue of the shortlisting process, how is it done in your department, the issue of the appointment of selection committees, the processes that need to be followed once the selection committee has made its recommendations. We have noted that you have this kind of recruitment policies missing, including basic record keeping that has to be done at the level of the recruitment and selection process. So you have instances where the outcomes of these processes are being challenged, therefore they cannot be finalized. And when these are raised with us as grievances, you find that the documentary evidence is not even there. And one of the major recommendations we have made is to make sure that departments improve record keeping when it comes to recruitment and selection. So that's another basic area that adds to the delays. However, a key issue we raised in a previous report on vacancy rates in the public service also is what defines the vacancy. Because you have departments having posts on the organogram which are not funded, and then they call them vacancies. They can't fill them, because the money is not there to pay for those posts. And in that particular report, we raised a number of the recommendations to make sure that the public service cleans up this area of dealing with vacancies. But a major contributing factor is the internal department-specific recruitment and selection procedures. If you have tight recruitment and selection procedures at that level, and there's clarity of roles, at what level do we sign off the appointment of a deputy director as opposed to a chief director, and so on and so on. That will help facilitate dealing with the issue of vacancies. Integrated skills development, I think to the extent that we've been involved in terms of oversight work here, it has been on reporting on the extent to which departments comply with the relevant skills development legislation and the quality of the skills development plans that they put in place. That's where we have come in. In this transversal M&E system that we use, when we look at the eighth principle in the constitutional, the eighth one, which talks about a human, effective human resource management in the public service. One of the things we look at is skills development, and we ask, do they have a skills development plan in place? Do they access the skills levy? Of course, a critical gap here, I think, Honorable Gani, it's that the determination of what goes into the skills plan. That's where a major weakness is. How do you end up with a workplace skills plan? What normally happens is that in performance agreements, there is a personal development plan where I say, well, I think I need to grow in this area, that area, and that area. And if that is what is then taken into the skills development plan, it's not a very thorough process of assessing the skills development needs of it's me as an individual saying I feel I need to grow in this area, and that then translates into the workplace skills plan. That becomes the biggest challenge, because even at the end of the day, when we try to assess the effectiveness of skills development, if that's how the skills development needs are determined in the first place, there is a gap there that needs to be addressed. And we have raised that in the report that we produce on the training needs of senior managers. We have a report on that, but also on the annual consolidated M&E report that we produce, because around Principle 8, the issue of skills development is one of those that we look at closely.
Just to add, in this area of skills development, and I think there was one other, just to say that the portfolio committee as well is at liberty to look and review the work plan of the Public Service Commission and make suggestions in terms of what area are crucial in the deliberations of the portfolio committee. So the Public Service Commission is open to suggestions in areas where the portfolio committee thinks we should be doing research and some studies.
Okay, members, is there any other thing? But just just one point I just need to raise that I've noticed quite clearly that the Public Service Commission is vehemently opposed to the integration of implementation of gender within the performance contract. I understand, but the way it's being opposed is in a way that, we can't put all those other things, we can't nationalism. And the way they put it is like, hey, no. It's a scary factor, it can't come in. Okay. But nonetheless, I wouldn't really want to challenge you on that. But, I thought I wouldn't even raise it. But, what interested me is that when Dr. Gitima was raising the issue of, how we have to comply with the law. And then he was talking about, he referred to an earlier presentation of the general audit of South Africa here, which was done earlier on, and then he talks about what happens if you've got continuous streamers, that's exactly what was said earlier on, that what do you do if they're continuous. And I can equally ask, what happens if, there's a clear law that says, in Chapter 1, the founding provision, that the Republic of South Africa is one sovereign democratic state founded on the following beliefs, and then amongst them we've got B, non-racialism and non-sexism. And every time after a head of department has finished the contract, sees, for instance, maybe in public works, they involve all the engineers. They said, no, there are no women engineers. We don't have them. And it's after 5 years. The other one comes, goes for 5 years, and what happens? Because to me, it's also disclaiming. In another area, what happens if that's the case? Because the area that we're talking about is disability and gender. And perhaps just to move forward, one can, I would say, okay, maybe we need to say, look into where are other areas where we can look into this matter. The same way as the Auditor General does it with the issues of, they do have those ways of making audits. But also there are national treasury roles, which then outlines the whole rule is how to do it. Perhaps in our case, we can actually start to say, seeing that we've got a new minister of women and the people with disabilities, perhaps we can commission the area of the national treasury, where they can outline the rules in terms of how that implementation, implementation can take place, but you can't ignore it. You know, perhaps, well, let's leave the area of integrating it within the what we call it, performance agreement. You know, I understand, you know, it's a no-no. But we can utilize other ways, like using the ministry, which can outline the rules in terms of how to be, how can we achieve, because quite painfully so, the disability is not really implemented. We miss out on that, and it's a bad thing to happen. It's a disclaimer, which is quite horrible. You know, we can't continue to talk smartly while we have that. But perhaps let's assume that while we do this work, we can get away where the minister responsible can outline very clear rules where all the departments have to comply in terms of disability, in terms of gender as well, so that it's not missed out, because it's very critical. And it's very painful. We can't say we're implementing gender when we have numbers of women going to parliament or occupying these positions without having an impact, practical impact on the ground in the poverty reduction. You talked about the issue of poverty, and you even indicated that I think that you were saying that you can get a zero from most departments when you challenge that area. So I think let's look into all those areas concurrently and come up with a reasonable way, of course, of ensuring that we move forward. I don't know if there's any other thing, but I think because the commitment that we had with the Public Service Commission is taking forward the areas that they've identified. And in my opinion, I think we then need a work session with them where we therefore put it as a plan starting from next year where we enter into that area. I think the presentation was very clear as well to identify that areas where we feel that we've done much. You know, we do have ears, we understand that now we need to take up that task, and like I indicated, we're very much ready to do that, we want to do it. So we will be ready to do that. But let's enter into a work session, the Public Service Commission and ourselves, come up with a plan, implement it. The next time we meet, we evaluate how far we are, starting from January, in terms of the implementation. Dr. Kitchen.
Thank you, Chair. No, I think that the plan would be most welcome in the area of the recommendations of the Public Service Commission and also the recommendations of the Auditor General, as you were saying here, because as well there is the area of discretionary audits that also, you know, he recognizes the gap there. So I think that we would appreciate very much a plan that looks into that area. In so far as the monitoring of the Public Service Commission in the area of gender and disability, we have been monitoring the public service quite consistently in this area, and that is why in our State of the Public Service throughout the years we have actually outlined what are the shortcomings. We did find that the shortcomings, is particularly in gender representativity, are in senior management, and that on disabilities the situation is quite hopeless. Subsequently, I think in 2008, we had hearings in departments throughout the country. We called the HODs, we summoned the HODs to come, especially those that were doing badly in the area, to hear what their submissions were in this particular area, and we have a report in that. So it is not as if the Public Service Commission is not committed to this constitutional bill. It is part of that. But I think what the acting DG, the point that the acting DG was making was that in formulating these performance agreements, there ought to be a deliberate plan to do that. So that, you know, one doesn't wake up today, think about the lapse that is happening in the public service, and then put it, so that you end up with a long list of a performance agreement that is not managing. So in the area of performance, one has to be very decisive in terms of what are the things that need to be achieved. We know that a lot more needs to be achieved in any particular area. But we think that if one focuses on a number of indicators. One is able to achieve much more than if you cloud the manager in a performance agreement. But that does not mean that those things that are there are not important. But it's just the capacity issues that come into play. But I think we need, and I think you're making the right input, Chair, that we need to be very vigilant in this particular area, because there is a lot of work to be done. We are not meeting the targets on disability. We are not meeting the targets on gender representativity at a higher level.
Okay. I think we are moving from a common ground, you know, in terms of we will definitely look into it in a way that, you know, to make it happen. So that's we are agreeing on that. But what we then need to do, can we concretize the date, you know, find dates from the Public Service Commission and ourselves where we can be available to develop that plan of action that we then can come back to evaluate. Once we come here, meeting together, it will be an evaluation. Except if there's a situation where the cluster would still want an interaction at that level, I'm sure we would then have to oblige with the cluster if they want another. But let's have that commitment. While there is that happening, we have an implementation of these agreements taking place. We really appreciate the presentations today, you know. And also, I really appreciate that you also pull the Auditor General once we do this. I'm sure we definitely have to do it that way. Once we do that work session, can we also include the Auditor General so that it becomes real concrete in terms of our way forward? I don't know if there's anything to raise. If there is nothing to raise, okay, Honorable Bikani wants to raise something.
One issue, Chair, is that also part of our approach should try the approach of actually looking or taking into consideration the issue of the integrated public service that is in the pipeline. And in whatever we try and do to coordinate and form finish in the work we are trying to do, we mustn't leave that behind, because I think there's going to be a lot of legislation review or changes and processes that need to take place. Just also to ensure that you're not leaving it behind. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, maybe that is a different process. It's a legislation moving into the area of the legislation. It will involve all of us, of course. We will get involved in various ways in terms of developing it. But in this case, we're talking about the annual report, the background of things that were never implemented in the past that should be brought as well, the Auditor General and ourselves, the implementation of what hasn't been happening, and the vigilancy in terms of the program of doing that. Perhaps some of the things we can sort of tackle them now, while we are still on constituency work and oversight period. So I think for now, let's focus on that, but we will engage in terms of the integrated public service approach that we get started from the cluster discussion, and it will continue to be discussed over and over. And can I take this opportunity to then thank the Public Service Commission, the Auditor General's office in absentia, in terms of the final sitting of this committee for this year. And I want to believe that even if the committee won't be sitting, work will be taking place behind the scenes, because we've got a lot to do prior to us taking a break for the festive. So I would like to really thank all the activities, and I must congratulate the members that we stick to our annual plan. It's still going to proceed. We've implemented all the areas. And that's why it's important for us to include our stakeholders when we plan moving forward, so that it doesn't leave out issues that we've already identified. And we've reached not the end of the year. The year is still long. The work is still a lot. Work sessions and all the implementation on our stakeholders that we've already identified as the committee. But we want to wish everyone that you won't see from now happy festive season, which we normally don't get because we get into conferences and all these other things. We just hope people will have that. And just to also announce that there is a killer that is arranged for the committee and all the stakeholders, the Public Service Commission, and all the institutions of the Department of Public Service and Administration, the department itself. The venue, what was it? PKL restaurant. It's in Queen Point. Green Point, yes. Yes, and then we hope that we are all still going to meet there. And I hope you're not leaving me, Public Service Commission. You know? Great. We hope the acting DJ will be there as well, you know, because it's an interaction, you know, we've been always engaging quite formally. We just need that informal interaction just once so that we can sort of talk informally about all the issues that we raised. And I know we won't be disappointed because that's the only time we have. And I hope to see you later, honorable members. And there's a hand from Honorable Franska.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to say from Aunt Andrea and myself, being the last committee meeting, etc., thank you very much to all the members of the Portfolio Committee for very constructive discussions during the year. We really enjoy being part of this committee. To you, Chair, thank you very much for your leadership, and Razia, thank you very much for what you do, all your work, and to the researcher as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That is encouraging, Honorable Franz Kazi. And thanks, Honorable Members. Let's meet you a bit later. So.